This is Bill Giddings, and the topic today is the greenhouse effect, more than hot air, with a question mark at the end. And we'll see later on why the question mark, although there can be no question but what there is a real greenhouse effect, and it is responsible for the Earth being habitable to life as we know it. The presence of trace amounts of gases in our atmosphere keep the globe's average temperature some 55 degrees warmer than it would be without them, and life as we know it depends on water being liquid inside us, as well as home to many other forms of life. The only major import that the Earth gets is solar energy, and the only major export from the planet is heat. And unless the amount of energy coming in equals the amount of energy going out, then the average temperature of the Earth is going to have to change. So of the sunlight that is aimed toward the Earth, about a quarter of it is reflected back from the atmosphere, from the clouds, from the dust, and simply from the air molecules themselves. Another quarter of it is absorbed by the air and warms it. Maybe 5% overall reflected back from the surface of the Earth. And then the rest of it soaks in to the surface and becomes heat. And so that adds up to 30% altogether that bounces right back out, and 70% that stays in, gets converted to heat, and then has to be radiated out in the form of heat waves, or infrared radiation, it's called. Now, of course, there's a very complex exchange of heat between the land, the water, and the air, but that doesn't change the balance of amount in and amount out unless something changes about the land, the water, and the air. The amount that bounces off of land versus ice versus water, forests versus desert, and particularly what we're talking about today, the amount of heat that gets soaked up in the atmosphere instead of going back out to space. Now, the molecules in the air that absorb that infrared heat energy are mainly water and carbon dioxide, abbreviated CO2. Now, water mainly goes round and round between the water vapor in the air, the clouds, the rain and snow, the ice in the oceans, and so the amount that's in the air is somewhat self-limiting before it comes back down to Earth again, although of course we know it varies a lot from time to time and from place to place. Although the record does also show that the water vapor content above the Pacific Ocean or near the equator has increased measurably by quite a bit, 20 to 30% since 1965, which then helps hold more heat in. But the main attention in the greenhouse effect has been given to carbon dioxide, CO2. Precise measurements of the amount of carbon dioxide in the air have been made for nearly 40 years from the top of Mauna Loa in Hawaii, which has thousands of miles of Pacific Ocean between it and any major human source of carbon dioxide. And so those readings are taken to reflect the average carbon dioxide level in the air in the northern hemisphere. Actually, the air does not mix much across the equator. And the amount of carbon dioxide in the air as measured is up more than 10% in the last 30 years. And it's estimated that it has increased 30% over the 125 years or so of industrialization and use of coal, petroleum, and natural gas as fuels. Now, carbon dioxide gets into the air naturally as vegetation decays, as volcanoes erupt and forest fires burn. Carbon dioxide is used from the air in the process of photosynthesis, when green plants grow. So when we burn wood to heat here in the winter, all of the carbon dioxide that that tree used up from the air in growing gets released back quickly into the air as it's burned. If, on the other hand, the tree falls in the forest and rots, then the same thing happens slowly. All the carbon dioxide used to build that tree goes back into the air, and the balance is maintained. But when we dig up coal, oil, or natural gas from under the ground, then that's putting new carbon dioxide in the air, at least carbon dioxide that hasn't been in the air for millions of years. When trees are cut faster than trees grow, then extra carbon dioxide is put in the air as those are burned compared to what was there before. Now, up to half of the extra carbon dioxide that human activity has been putting in the air dissolves in the ocean, and the rest pretty much stays in the air. There have been arguments between the oceanographers and the biologists about whether the total amount of carbon in living vegetation has been increasing or decreasing worldwide, but a study published last December attributes anywhere from 20 to 60% of the extra carbon dioxide warming to burning of biomass, whether it's to clear tropical lands for agriculture or simply to serve as the major energy source for 2/3 of the world's population. And there is concern by some that the process of the ocean's circulation to absorb the carbon dioxide from the air, which can only go in at the surface, to soak up much then depends on the deep water coming up and the surface water going down. And there's concern that if the temperature rises too much, that grand circulation pattern, conveyor belt, they call it, may be affected, and the ocean may suddenly stop being able to absorb the carbon dioxide, and things get much worse very rapidly. Now, it's been realized more recently that carbon dioxide is only half or a little more of the greenhouse effect problem. There are several other gases which, taken together, may add up to nearly as much effect as carbon dioxide. And I've represented that over here. I've purposely not put on any numbers because every chart you see, the numbers will be a little different. Nobody can know, measure exactly how much is in the air all over the whole world. But carbon dioxide, half or a little more. Next biggest contributor, CFCs is the abbreviation for chlorofluorocarbons. Those are compounds which do not occur in nature. They're compounds that have been much used in spray cans, although no longer so for consumer products in this country. They still are in other countries. They have been used as the foam in styrofoam, no longer used for that in this country. They are used in refrigerators and air conditioners as the fluid that transfers the heat, and they're used for cleaning purposes in the electronics industry and get into the air from all of those applications. Also, methane, abbreviated by the chemists as CH4, gets into the air naturally, but this is natural gas. As we use natural gas and some leaks, it gets into the air from that source. Of course, natural gas is produced by bacteria decaying plant material, and that takes place in swamps and wetlands. It also takes place in rice paddies, which are artificial wetlands. And it takes place in the guts of cattle and termites, and those are actually major contributors to the amount of methane in the atmosphere. It's been increasing by over 1% per year, which is greater than the rate of increase of carbon dioxide. There isn't nearly as much of it, but each molecule of it will soak up 30 times as much heat as a molecule of carbon dioxide. So it makes a major contribution. The chlorofluorocarbons are 10,000 times as effective in soaking up heat as carbon dioxide. So a little bit of that goes a very long way. And then finally, nitrous oxide, abbreviated N2O, gets in the air from agricultural operations. Over-fertilization releases some of the nitrogen added in this form. It also gets released when things are burned without enough air to burn completely and cleanly, and is increasing more rapidly than carbon dioxide is.
Bill,
yes.
You said about methane being produced by cattle and termites. Mm-hmm. Are those the only creatures that produce methane?
No, but they are the ones that are present in, by far, the greatest numbers.
Termites.
Well, I read that there is something like half a ton of termites for every living person on Earth. Mm-hmm. And as land gets cleared and lots more wood lies around on the ground, then the termite population increases. So human activity contributes to that. And of course, most cattle are raised on purpose by humans.
Okay, so that's why people would make the argument about eating less meat would contribute to helping the environment?
That's one reason.
I mean, one reason.
Yeah, another reason is the tremendous amount of energy that goes into intensive agriculture, which
and contributes. And I think most of us have thought of that, mm-hmm. but the other, I think I'd heard of that other, about mm-hmm. the methane gas, but I didn't understand
it. Don't all mammals?
No, those are just the ruminants, those that chew their cud and then have several stomachs are host to the bacteria in that first stomach that do this problem. Others produce some, but not nearly to the extent that the cattle, well, deer do also, but there aren't so many of them.
There was something in the news article here, it was a few months back, about some attack they make now to pass on to a cow that...
To measure?
Well, no.
Or
that
to actually?
Actually acts against the...
Hmm.
Huh.
Yeah.
I know they're doing research on it, and some people have poked fun at that, but actually it is a significant part of the problem. And, of course, carbon dioxide is from burning coal, oil, natural gas, or burning wood faster than you grow it. And if you take into account all of these contributions to the greenhouse effect as well as you can, then of course the United States end up as number one, the Soviet Union as number two, but more recent studies put Brazil, China, and India as numbers 3, 4, and 5. Brazil because of the deforestation.
Yeah.
And China burns more coal than the United States, although it's much less per person. There are so many more persons there. And India, well, also the rice paddies, and India from rice growing and livestock.
I have a question about
yes.
the chart. That shows the relative amounts, right?
The relative contributions to the global warming problem, not the relative.
So that takes into account the 10,000 times
right.
heat absorption.
If you're just looking at the amount in the air, then since there's so much carbon dioxide there naturally, the chlorofluorocarbons wouldn't even show up on the same chart. But because they're so efficient, then they show there.
Does that chart show the actual amount in the air now, or does that show the amount we're putting into the air?
Well, that represents, again, I should be more careful, not the total amount or effect in the air, but the effect of human activity in increasing the greenhouse effect.
We're putting in.
Yeah, the extra CO2 that we're putting in.
So that shows the extra amounts, not the natural input, not the natural.
Thank you for clearing that up. So, how do we make measurements of the average temperature of the Earth? Well, we're not going to be able to measure it everywhere. So we take all the measurements we've got. Where are most of the measurements? Well, where most of the people are. And of course, that's where most of the land is, and that's the northern hemisphere. So just as in very many other things, there's a northern hemisphere bias to these averages. And sometimes what's happening from the measurements they have in the southern hemisphere seems like it may be going in an opposite direction. And of course, most of these things are released in the northern hemisphere also, because they're released by human activity. Now, we can see that, as best we know the average temperature, that it has bounced around a lot. And as I was going through my files, I found some articles from 10 or 15 years ago that were concerned about the global cooling, and it looked as if we were on the way to a new ice age. Well, how have our worries turned 180 degrees around? Well, it all depends on what section of the record and how long a time you're looking for at. Then they were looking at that. Things are cooling off. Now, of course, oh my, things are increasing tremendously rapidly. But if we take a little longer view, they're increasing all right, but not nearly as fast as it looks like recently. And of course, you can't go back a whole lot before that and have any reasonable, accurate data at all, because people simply weren't taking the measurements very many places.
So where in time is that kind of a low dip that's fairly near 1990?
I think actually it's around 1946.
Okay, so that would be certainly within the memory of lots of people.
Right.
So when folks in the Midwest say, oh, well, we used to have these big, gigantic snowstorms and it used to be colder and all that, mm-hmm. It really was.
Yeah.
It isn't just sort of
my parents,
exaggeration of memories or whatever.
My parents were over on Lindley Island as children, and they ice skated every summer. And there have been two times since I was born that you could ice skate on the other side of the mountains on fairly sizable lakes that were thick enough that the ice got, you know, was cold enough long enough to make ice thick enough to ice skate on. And sometimes the lakes will freeze over, but they've never been available to me to ice skate on. And so it was colder then.
Well, I can definitely see in my lifetime, you know, when I was a kid living in the northwest part of Montana, where the winters back then were much more severe than what they are now. Mm-hmm. Maybe that would be.
And of course, this is the global average too, and things are different in different places at different times.
When these gases go up into the air, do they become part of the air?
Yes.
So when the wind blows, the gases move along with the wind.
Exactly.
And so would that mean the southern hemisphere isn't going to heat up as much? Because you said there wasn't much air exchange between the northern and southern hemisphere.
That's right.
So that means we'd be getting hotter a lot faster than people down in the southern hemisphere would?
That's right. On the other hand, there are a lot more people in the northern hemisphere to be affected by it,
right,
too.
Watch them all move to the southern hemisphere.
Yeah. Well, come tomorrow and hear about the ozone layer, and you may decide there are reasons to stay up here.
Yeah, right.
But you can see from this why the fact that out of the last 10 years broke heat records doesn't necessarily prove anything about the greenhouse effect showing up already. although as 45 cities topped 100 degrees on the same day in 1988, Dr. James Hansen of NASA was telling a U.S. Senate committee that there wasn't a chance in 100 that that could have happened other than the greenhouse effect. Then the White House Office of Management and Budget changed Hansen's pre-printed text to Congress to tone down his warnings, but Dr. Hansen had said in person what he intended to say. His computer model was the most elaborate in the world, and 1990 is the hottest year on record. However, others say that because of the natural bouncing around, we don't really understand that it will take 10 to 20 more years to see whether the effect is happening yet. But that's not the important question of whether it's happening yet, because what we put in the air is going to stay there for a very long time. And we may have already done the damage, even though it may not have shown up yet.
You so, mean like 50 years or what do you mean?
Well, it depends on which ones. 50, 100, somewhere like that. The chlorofluorocarbons stay around longer. I had something on that, but here it is. For half of what's in the air to go away, methane doesn't stay very long. It gets chewed up in reactions in the atmosphere. In 50 years, it'd all be gone. But carbon dioxide takes 150 years or 100 years to go to half its level, and nitrous oxide, similar, the chlorofluorocarbons, maybe more like 50, 60 years. So why is warmer a problem, except for being uncomfortably hot?
Excuse me, before you go on, does this mean if we stopped, if we greatly reduced those levels,
mm-hmm.
then over time it would correct itself, that the ozone
get back into balance, right. Well, depending on which computer model you want to use, the projection is that within the next 100 to 200 years, global temperature could and likely will rise to a higher level than any time in the last 120,000 years. And that's maybe only 5 to 10 degrees higher than now. But the last ice age was only 10 degrees cooler than now. And there's no history to compare that with, to get an idea of what it really will mean. The computer models predict shifts of the weather and climate patterns, that some places will get drier as a result of being hotter, and maybe the U.S. Midwest will become a desert. Some recent summers there began to look like things were moving in that direction, and California is now in its fourth successive year of drought. That more severe storms and more extremes of hot and cold would result, more severe floods and droughts, and of course we know already there were 100,000 or more dead in Bangladesh from a single typhoon event. Well, then other areas farther north, like Canada and Siberia, will get better growing seasons, but they say their soils aren't as good as the present grain-producing regions of the U.S. and Ukraine and so forth. And we know that droughts within the normal historical ranges have brought widespread starvation in Africa in the dry years. We know that on the U.S. West Coast, warmer weathers could mean less snow and more rain in the winter, which would mean more floods and less electricity, as the snowpack is where the water gets stored and released when we need the electricity. Some places, no doubt, will be better off. Others, unquestionably, would be worse off, and we can't count at all on which areas will be better off and which will be worse off. Now, it's true that as crops grow, they take carbon dioxide from the air, so more carbon dioxide in the air should make crops grow better. It does in some cases, but they find that when they grow then, they get more fiber, have less protein, and although there's more of it, it's poorer food. But one of major concern is for rising temperatures, melting glaciers and polar ice caps, and making the levels of the ocean rise. And of course, as the oceans get warmer, then that expands and makes the level rise, even if more ice didn't melt. A third of the world's population live near sea level. Already there are problems with sinking land because of geological plates tipping as well as rising sea levels. In London, Tokyo, Osaka, Bangkok, Shanghai, Miami, Houston, New Orleans, Los Angeles.
Mexico City.
Yeah, that's not on the coast, so it's not sea level doesn't have anything to do with that one.
Well, that's true. That's because they're pumping their water out from underneath.
But some of the Los Angeles has some of that on top of these other factors, too. Bangladesh could lose a sixth of its total land area if sea level rose a few feet. Bangladesh. For a 3-foot rise in sea level, Egypt could lose 20% of the land suitable for growing crops. The Marshall Islands, the Maldive Islands, and some in the Caribbean would be completely submerged. And in some of the extreme scenarios where water would rise by tens of feet, the whole state of Florida might disappear underwater. Now, of course, these are all calculated from computer models. Models are deliberate oversimplifications because things are too complicated to understand completely and represent precisely mathematically. So there are many uncertainties. The biggest uncertainties in these climate models are the effects of clouds and the role of the ocean and ocean circulation, as I mentioned before. So I can only suggest examples of some of the other complications that could make the effect greater or less than the models predict. Things that amplify the effect are called positive feedback, as if microphone is picking something up from a loudspeaker and begins to squeal. As we melt the ice, then less sunlight will be reflected. Water primarily absorbs the light that goes on it. Ice primarily sends it back. And so that would make more warming to melt more ice to make things worse. As the ocean warms up, the amount of carbon dioxide it can hold goes down. So carbon dioxide would be released from the ocean and make the effect worse. They found that the permafrost regions of the Arctic have a lot of methane caught in the ice. If we melt the permafrost, all of that methane gets released from the ice, and also a lot more wetland activity there produces more methane from the natural processes, and things get worse and worse. On the other hand, there are negative feedback, things which tend to restore toward a balance. As the water gets warmer, more of it will evaporate. That should lead to more clouds. More clouds would mean more sunlight gets reflected back and never gets into the earth, which would lead to a cooling, which could lead to ice sheets expanding, which would mean more reflected. If it was clear weather, and warming could in fact trigger an ice age. Well, what are we going to do about the question? We are probably not going to return the world to a pre-industrial state and quit burning coal, petroleum, or natural gas, at least while we can still get it and can still afford it. In 1988, 48 countries sent delegates to a conference in Toronto, International Conference on the Changing Atmosphere, and they called for the industrialized nations to cut back 20% on their carbon dioxide releases by the year 2005. To stabilize things at the present level, they would have to cut back 50%, but they thought that was a little too much to ask that quickly. One, another thing that is being considered very.
How did it go? I mean, they made this pronouncement, then did anybody take any action on that?
Well, there's a whole series of conferences and actions and agreements and lack of agreements that I'll get to in a minute.
Okay.
Reducing deforestation would make a big contribution also towards reducing the greenhouse effect. In 1989, at a conference in Boulder, the delegate from Jamaica said, "And if deforestation is so important, couldn't forgiving the debts of developing nations be seen as a good investment?" Now, that argument applies many times over to Brazil, which has the largest debt and the largest deforestation, and although the rate seems to have been decreasing in Brazil, the total amount is still very great. And besides not cutting trees so fast, you need to be planting more of them to overcome this carbon dioxide contribution. We need to plant enough new forest to cover Australia, which isn't the best place to grow trees.
Is that rainforest trees or any trees?
Any trees, but fast growing trees, of course, are absorbing it more quickly. Rainforest trees tend to grow fast, but mature forests don't continue to take up more carbon dioxide particularly.
But they're bigger.
Well, but they're also releasing more from their respiration. Trees breathe too and are contributors as well as absorbers of carbon dioxide. So it's the young forests that...
That's an argument to cut down the old growth.
Really?
No, it's an argument
yeah,
to...
Yeah, because that would be... Would that mean that if you cut down trees and planted new ones, that it would be absorbing more?
But the trees are little.
Yeah, per acre, I don't know.
Because...
So here are some points of view on how we should.
They've already used it against
us. Sure.
Some points of view on how we should look at the issue. Chief of Water Resources for the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations in 1988, the risk is too large not to look for possible alternatives and means of mitigation, even if the search is based on predictions with a large margin of error. Forecasting is a dangerous game. Blind and passive waiting for a possible disaster is even more dangerous. Robert Jastrow, Department of Earth Sciences, Dartmouth College, 1990. If the decision on CO2 limits is made now and turns out to be wrong because it was based on inaccurate information, the cost to the United States could be staggering, an estimated $0.8 to $3.6 trillion. With a price tag like that, a few years of waiting for the fruits of an accelerated research program would seem to be in order. Prudence dictates spending a few $100 million to obtain guidance on the wisdom of decisions that could cost the United States trillions of dollars. Frederick Bernthal, Chief U.S. Negotiator on Climate Issues. The American people are not likely to forgive us if they are asked to make great sacrifices and we turn out to be wrong. A group of scientists from Oak Ridge National Laboratory. The costs of a decade-long worldwide effort to stabilize carbon dioxide are poorly known, but the costs are certainly less than A, other costs of sustainable development, such as protecting cropland, topsoil, and so forth. B, the costs of no action. Agroecosystem productivity losses due to less soil moisture in the United States alone are estimated at tens of billions of dollars and up to $100 billion to protect the U.S. East Coast shoreline alone against 3 feet of sea level rise. C, the costs of cleaning up sulfur, nitrogen, and particulate emissions from the fuels that we burn if we don't reduce the burning of them. D, global military expenditures, $1.3 trillion per year. So annual carbon dioxide removal costs could be paid by declaring peace for a few days. Or E, the global debt, $1.3 trillion for developing countries alone. One-tenth of this would cover most of the total reforestation and research costs. In the economic terms, it's far cheaper to recycle carbon by growing more trees than to adapt to climate change and continue our unsustainable path. A commentator, Strobe Talbot, in Time magazine in 1989, the U.S. has spent several trillion dollars over the past 40 years buying insurance against a Soviet nuclear attack. Global warming, by contrast, is not just a risk, but a certainty. It would be a shame if quibbling and ambivalence on the part of some Bush aides were to play into the hands of those who are looking for an excuse to do nothing. And some 700 scientists, including nearly half the members of the National Academy of Science, 49 Nobel Prize winners, signed an appeal to the U.S. government that starts out, "Global warming has emerged as the most serious environmental threat of the 21st century. There is broad agreement within the scientific community that amplification of the Earth's natural greenhouse effect by the buildup of various gases introduced by human activity has the potential to produce dramatic changes in climate. The severity and rate of climate change cannot be confidently predicted, but the impacts of changes in surface temperature, sea level, precipitation, and other components of climate could be substantial and irreversible on a time scale of centuries, result in severe disruption of natural and economic systems throughout the world. Uncertainty is no excuse for complacency. Only by taking action now can we ensure that future generations will not be put at risk." Well, what is being done about it? November of 89, 60 countries confer in the Netherlands, which is particularly concerned about sea level rise. Most of those countries voted on a freeze of carbon dioxide emissions at current levels for 10 years. But the Bush administration said it's too early and too extreme to talk about doing that. We have to study the economic impact first. Japan and the Soviet Union were the only other two countries who opposed that proposal, partly on the basis that we were involved in a study sponsored by the United Nations, which was underway, and its results weren't out yet, but were expected in a few months. February of 90, President Bush addressed that group, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that was doing that study for the United Nations, still called for more research before action. Same month, the US EPA estimated that to keep atmospheric carbon dioxide at the same level it is now, we'd have to cut emissions 50% to 80% back to 1950s level. And one significant difference in the way we live now compared to then is they didn't have air conditioning then, any significant amount. The U.S. government proposed there be set up a global market in emission allowances, give each country a certain amount they'd be allowed to put out, and if they didn't want to put out that much, they could sell those rights to somebody else. And that same month was this appeal by the American scientists. April of 90, Global Warming Conference, 18 nations met in Washington, D.C. at the invitation of the White House. Most delegates agreed that the threat was real and serious. The U.S. has earmarked $1 billion for global climate research for 1991 and has agreed, for reasons I'll go into tomorrow, to phase out production of the chlorofluorocarbons completely by the year 2000 and to plant 1 billion trees in that time period. August of 90, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change met in Sweden. The science group reported they had agreed on a likely 6 degree rise in temperature by the year 2100 and a 2 foot rise in sea level by then. 74 countries agreed on a draft for discussion. The agreement was reached at 3:30 a.m. after the interpreters had quit, and they could keep going only by agreeing to conduct their deliberations all in English. November of 90, the Second World Climate Conference met in Geneva, and that same month, the 12 European Community countries agreed to stabilize their carbon dioxide emission levels by the year 2000. January of this year, the EPA reported that the U.S. has already stabilized its total greenhouse gas emissions. Mostly, that's by agreeing to phase out the chlorofluorocarbons and to plant the trees and to look at efficiency standards for appliances. February of 91, 130 countries met again near Washington, D.C., hosted by the United States. Congress's Office of Technology Assessment said that carbon dioxide can be curbed without crippling the economy or losing our comfort or convenience. And if we're going to actually cut it by 20 to 35% by the year 2015, it would cost us $150 billion a year. Just to keep the increase in carbon dioxide by then down to 20% instead of 50% could actually save us money if the price of oil had risen to $50 billion by then, and so we weren't burning so much. And last February, the United States at that conference in its closing moments did agree to negotiate carbon dioxide limits, the first time our government has agreed to do that. But in the process had prevented substantive discussions at that meeting of how that might be done. And also last February, Senator Timothy Wirth of Colorado and 48 co-sponsors introduced a bill into the U.S. Senate to cut carbon dioxide emissions 20% by the year 2005. I don't have any report on whether that bill has gone anyplace or not. And in April, the National Academy of Sciences reported that much can be done cheaply, and some of it at a net economic benefit in conserving energy to address this problem. And it isn't that nobody else had said these same things before, but that this is the National Academy of Sciences, and their report presumably reflects a change in the attitude of the U.S. administration. Now, as far as how our energy use could be cut, I think that's a little much to get into at this time. I'll be discussing with you national energy policy, again with a question mark at the end of it, at a session on Saturday, but definitely something would need to be done in that regard. A woman in Congress representing Rhode Island has pointed out, though, that this is an issue where individual actions can make more difference than in most any other issue. And as far as what we can do as individuals, that's all been compiled for us by Al Pitcher over the last couple of years. It's entitled On Earth as in Heaven, On Living Toward God's Future, and there are copies of it available on the table right outside the door. There are also other things in the Resource Center, including a copy to be looked at there of a special issue of Scientific American, September of 89, on managing planet Earth that talks about this and a number of other global environmental problems.
Just,
yeah.
Does everybody know where the Resource Center is? Just down the hall here in first room to left.
Thank you.
Would you stress that again about, you said something about individual actions really would make a difference or whatever. Sometimes when we talk about these matters and people talk about what one individual can do, people sort of laugh at that.
Well, as Al says, any reduction in the use of electricity produced by burning fossil fuels or any use of coal, oil, or gas for heating or manufacturing purposes will reduce the amount of carbon dioxide released in the atmosphere. Even if electricity is produced by water power, ordinarily saving electricity will allow water power-produced electricity to be used in other places in place of fossil fuel-produced electricity. And so we do use energy ourselves directly, and that's a significant fraction of the energy that's used. A lot more of it is used on our behalf in producing products. If we don't buy them, they won't be produced. And what one person does may not add up to much, but what everybody does adds up to pretty much the whole problem.
I have a question about the chlorofluorocarbons.
Yeah.
You said that we, our countries agreed to stop production?
But within the next 10 years, yes.
What does that mean then for our air conditioning systems? Does that mean there are alternatives?
Well, it means that we'll have to use something else. It's not entirely clear what those alternatives will be because they have some in mind, but they take several years to test them for safety, for example. See
so
how toxic they are.
Developed.
They will not work as well. They can't just be put into the existing air conditioners in place of what we now use. You'd need to replace the equipment, and then, of course, that's a problem. And
refrigeration, too.
Yeah, will not be as efficient.
So we're talking about having to buy new refrigerators and different kind of air conditioners within the next 10 years. Or within the next 20 years or whatever.
Yeah.
The supply will run out.
Actually, your household refrigerator, by the time the refrigerant goes out of that, generally people have been replacing those anyhow.
Oh,
it's the automobile air conditioners that getting charged up every year or two that also tend to leak the most, and so that's where it's going to hit hardest and hit first.
Oh yeah, you should mention about those. People should only go to the...
Well, I believe that there is now a law in this state that any place that services your air conditioner and recharges it has to collect the chlorofluorocarbons that were in it and can't just let them off into the air the way they used to.
And there are some little kits that you can buy to recharge your air conditioner, and
I'm not sure whether you could.
Not a good idea. I hope you can't buy them, but you might.
Yeah, I haven't looked to see. I think those also have been outlawed, but I don't know what the effective date of the law is. And of course, that's one state. There are other states that have done the same thing. In fact, in Vermont, you can't buy a automobile with an air conditioner that uses chlorofluorocarbons, I'm told.
So if we have a vehicle that does have an air conditioner, then just not getting it recharged.
Well, go to an outlet that will capture the...
And then what do they do with it once they've captured it?
Well, they reuse it.
Yeah, they reuse it. Just don't let it go into the air.
So it's not costing our environment, too, if you go to a place like that to use your air conditioner to have it recharged.
It's only what leaks out that is the problem. Ultimately, it will all leak out. Unless when the car is junked, the junkyard collects it.
They might.
And that might happen by then.
So,
but
so it's not while you're actually using the air conditioner that the
chlorofluorocarbons
that just goes round and round.
Yeah, the use of it doesn't let it out into the air. It's the leaking of it that does. And whether it leaks faster if you use it than if you don't, I'm not sure. Of course, it does use more gasoline to use the air conditioner, and that lets more carbon dioxide loose. So there is reason to restrict your use of it and not use it unnecessarily.
Does your air conditioner in your car break down to the point that it's leaking, like you need to have it checked? Or is it only if it doesn't work that this,
Well, the people in the business of checking it advise you to get it checked every couple of years. How necessary that is, I really don't know. And of course, if it doesn't work, then carrying around all that extra weight for no benefit whatsoever wastes gasoline too.
So if one's going to choose not to use an air conditioner in a car, then you should have a drain of the, or have the chlorofluorocarbons taken out?
Well, if
you're... I don't even have a sense of what kind of thing we're talking about.
If you're going to that extent, you probably should have the air conditioner taken out too, because again, to carry around all that extra weight for no benefit, it just wastes gasoline. Well, there's quite a list here. On this issue, also on later pages, are citizen action regarding waste, so I'll be talking about those issues next week, and about the world economy, which is not our my area, ozone depletion I'm talking about tomorrow. Water, economic theory, and practice are not things that I'm prepared to talk about. And I did bring along two copies of a new publication by a couple of government agencies, reports to the nation on our changing planet, that explain the climate system. The introduction that I gave to the problem has some good visualizations of it. I have two copies here. I meant to bring more, but I couldn't get my suitcase closed with any more in it.
Well, thank you, Bill.
Thank you for coming, especially for participating.